Today is Thursday, April 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, China announces retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods.
I would take the president seriously on this tariff issue.
Well, the U.S. is looking to get out of Syria. The president signs a declaration ordering National Guard troops to the border with Mexico. Also ahead, Martin Luther King Jr. is remembered. It's all on today's International Edition. White House officials Wednesday laid out plans to send National Guard troops to the southern U.S. border with Mexico as part of the president's efforts to confront what he says is a growing problem of illegal immigration. The decision to deploy the U.S. military to the border represents a new aspect of Trump's wide-ranging immigration crackdown. But major parts of the move are unclear, including how many troops will be sent, when they will deploy, or exactly what they'll do. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said the troops will help with border surveillance and other support functions.
We've recently seen the numbers of illegal border crossings rise from 40-year lows last April to back to previous levels. Our current border security and immigration laws fail the American people. The system rewards bad behavior. It does not punish lawbreakers.
Well, joining us now to talk more about what this all means is national correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, can you explain all of this?
We heard the president say in a meeting yesterday that he wanted to, quote, send the military down to the border to address some of these border security issues that he's been concerned about on a long-running basis. Of course, that actually can't happen. If you follow U.S. law, the U.S. military is legally prevented from enforcement domestically, and for good reason. You don't want a military coup of any kind. You don't want the military arresting citizens. They are meant to deal with threats overseas. So the next option at President Trump's disposal was the National Guard. That's what we actually ended up hearing from the White House today, is that the White House is working with governors of the four border states to send the National Guard down to the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, the National Guard doesn't have free rein once they get down there. There are also laws that say that they can only go down there in really a support function for U.S. Border Patrol. They can assist, they can fill in some of the gaps that Border Patrol might have, but they absolutely cannot arrest people on U.S. soil.
So what happens next?
So that plan is still fluid from what we are hearing from the White House today. And that means that the White House has to really work out those nitty-gritty details with the governors of the four border states. You can't call the National Guard out for anything. You have to have some sort of emergency, a natural disaster, a riot, something of that kind that will give them kind of the plan for how they operate on the ground. So we're waiting to see how many boots on the ground will get there, what they'll be doing in tandem with Border Patrol once they get there, and how long they'll be there. That's a question that the Secretary of Homeland Security really couldn't answer when asked in the White House briefing. We do know that past U.S. presidents have mobilized the National Guard to go down to the U.S.-Mexico border. They've stayed anywhere from about a year and a half to 2 years.
My understanding is that we are seeing a much smaller number in undocumented people crossing the border. So why the sense of urgency?
Well, the White House will say that we are seeing a drop in undocumented immigrant crossings because of the, quote, Trump effect, that undocumented immigrants realize that if they come here, they will be caught, they will be policed. But it's actually part of a broader trend over several decades to see that drop in illegal immigrant crossings. That's been happening for a very, very long time now. What it's really triggered by is something that President Trump mentioned in a tweet a couple of days ago, and that's this caravan of migrants that makes its way from Central America and into Mexico on an annual basis. Some of those migrants do come to the U.S.-Mexico border, and they do apply for asylum to try and get into the U.S.
Right.
when they don't, some of them do end up crossing illegally. And that seemed to have sparked something in President Trump, who was tweeting about it quite angrily the other day.
You said it's up to the states because the National Guard is statewide. So if that's the case, would he have to ask leaders of the states that obviously border Mexico, like Arizona, Texas, California?
The governor of California, and who may not be too excited about this.
Right. It seems like the federal government is in somewhat of a war on a number of fronts with the state of California over sanctuary cities and other things. So I would imagine he would have to declare some sort of emergency to need to activate the National Guard.
That's right. And so that's part of what's being worked out with the governors right now. The White House really couldn't offer us a lot of details today, other than to say that the National Guard would, quote, immediately be sent down, that they considered this something that was of the highest urgency, and that they were addressing it completely and as soon as they possibly could.
And what if we have our National Guard members on the border there, and something like a serious hurricane or some other natural disaster strikes, would they be reassigned? How would that work? I would imagine we would need them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. What would happen in that scenario? That's something that the White House and the governors would, again, have to get together and work together to decide, well, where are our resources best needed on this hurricane or other natural disaster or in this situation on the border? And what we do know is that there are actually really good ratios of Border Patrol officers to undocumented immigrants. The Border Patrol is actually as staffed up as they possibly can be. They do receive a lot of federal funding to carry out that mission. So it's a question of really what the National Guard, if they're not carrying out the actual enforcement actions, what they're there to do and if they're actually needed in that situation.
All right. That's VOA national correspondent Catherine Jepson. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Chinese national gets 10 years in U.S. prison for stealing trade secrets. From a refugee camp, a young Somali lands a spot at Princeton University. Scientists debate a return to the moon, and a woman fired after making obscene gestures to Trump files a lawsuit. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the world's two biggest economies stand at the edge of the most perilous trade conflict since World War II. Financial markets bounced up and down on Wednesday over the brewing U.S.-China trade war after Beijing and Washington proposed tariffs on $50 billion worth of each other's products in a battle over the aggressive tactics China employs to develop its high-tech industries. Lawrence Kudlow, the top White House economic advisor, sought to ease fears of a deepening trade conflict with China, telling reporters the tariffs the U.S. announced Tuesday are potentially just a negotiating ploy.
Is it possible that these stiff new tariffs against China are, in fact, a negotiating tactic and won't go into effect?
Yes, it's possible. It's part of the process. I mean, I would take the president seriously on this tariff issue. You know, there are carrots and sticks in life. But he is ultimately a free trader. He said that to me. He said it publicly. So he wants to solve this with the least amount of pain. And again, here's a key point. Both sides benefit by positive solutions that lower barriers and open markets.
VOA's Ira Melman asked Charles Kane, senior lecturer on economics at the Sloan School of Management at MIT, for reaction on the standoff and if the economic advisor's comments would ease tensions.
He made the reference to back channels are already taking place and so on. If that's the case, then terrific. If there's a way of saving face on both sides without any sort of dragging it out into the open, which is what Mr. Trump loves to do, it would be a great way of resolving this. I do believe very strongly that intellectual property bad behavior on the Chinese part is absolutely true. It's a weight on both the tech industry in the U.S. and the biotech industry in particular, and it's not fair. It's a major detriment to the way in which companies look at how they can grow and invest in the future. So that has to be addressed, no question about it. To just do an across-the-board tariff on various industries without being specific and focused on what really is the issue is not the right approach. And it's, again, it's bringing something out into the open, it seems, more for political gain than you know, economic reality. I mean, this is not the way world economics should work, not in any way.
What is the way world economics should work?
The way world economics should work is an efficiency that the countries that can produce certain items at the most efficient pricing so that the consumer can benefit, which in this case, in many cases, is the American consumer getting a better quality and cheaper product. And that's the way that an open and free trade will allow the efficiencies to fall where they may. And the caveat there is when there is an intellectual property stolen, like the Chinese have done often in the past, then that's just not the correct way to run any kind of economic model. And it discourages any kind of long-term investment by companies that create, you know, technology advances and so on.
What happens to the downward movement of the market so far over the past the week or so since this tariff skirmish, if that's what you want to call it, has gone into effect?
Look what happens. If we put tariffs on, you can be damn sure that the Chinese will retaliate right back. It's going to be back and forth, out in the open. And the companies that are going to lose export capabilities here on the U.S. side are traded in the public markets. And so there you can expect that their results will be hit by this. And that's what you're seeing in the stock market. I mean, I can foresee if this does play out as a trade war, I can foresee some of these large companies like the airlines and even the car manufacturers will have to cite this as a reason for them missing numbers in the future. And that's what the market is interpreting.
What would you suggest the Trump administration do now?
I would suggest that, first of all, don't tweet when you're doing things like this so that it's an open war, because what happens then is it becomes something that has to be responded to, which is exactly what you get. What they should do is they should back-channel, like Larry Kudlow was referencing to, and negotiate something, particularly as it relates to intellectual property. There is no question that the Chinese have played bad here. Trade is a different story. I mean, we, the consumer in America, takes advantage of the trade efficiencies that China creates. But on intellectual property, there is no one gains from that. Everyone loses from that, except, of course, the Chinese companies that illegally resell and backward engineer American technology and advancement. That has to stop.
So what happens, what kind of leverage does the United States have to deal with it?
Well, I think if it can't be done through a negotiation process, which I don't know has been tried in the past, I think what Trump is really trying to do is to bring to light this issue by doing all this other stuff. But it's obviously having a disruptive impact on a lot of different areas. If he wants to play hardball, he's got to find a way, and I think if he can't do it back channel, then bring it out into the open. But be focused on what you're trying to penalize the Chinese on, not across-the-board product, which in reality we benefit a great deal from because of the efficiencies gained in global trade. So he's got to be focused and pinpointing on the areas that our intellectual property has been stolen and taken advantage of, and therefore discouraging our investment for future economic gain. So that's what really has to be done.
That's Charles Kane, senior lecturer on economics at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Well, Turkey, Iran, and Russia met Wednesday in Ankara and pledged to accelerate efforts to bring stability to Syria, underlining a joint commitment to the country a day after President Trump raised the prospect of withdrawing U.S. troops. The White House said the U.S. military mission to eradicate the Islamic State group in Syria is coming to a rapid end, but he offered no timetable for withdrawal. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Wednesday that the U.S. and its partners remain committed to eliminating the small Islamic State group presence that continues there.
The goal, again, is to defeat ISIS. And once we completely do that, we've made significant progress. And when there's no longer a need for troops to be there and we can transition to that local enforcement, that certainly would be the objective.
Well, VOA's Victor Beatty asks Mideast analyst Andrew Tabler with Washington Institute for Near East Policy if he's surprised about the meeting between Turkey, Iran, and Russia and what it all means.
Today's meeting tries to show a little bit about the alternative to the U.S. being in Syria and the contingency. And the contingency there, from Russia, Iran, and Ankara's point, is that it seems there is no transition in Syria, as the U.S. has outlined. And also, a ceasefire and other kinds of measures are done with that in mind. So not a transition away from Assad, but instead probably ensuring he's there for the foreseeable future.
How successful can these three countries be to bring about stability in Syria that has known nothing but agony for 7 years?
They can bring about stability in part of the country. They can't bring about stability in all of it. And the over one-third of the country that's in the hands of the Kurds, of course, they're the arch enemies, that particular group of the Turks. So how you would deliver them to this, I'm not sure.
A senior U.S. official, Andrew, said that President Trump wanted U.S. forces out of Syria relatively soon. Quote, we're not going to immediately withdraw, but neither is the president willing to back a long-term commitment. The White House insists that this will not encourage deeper Iranian involvement.
It would be hard to see how a U.S. rapid withdrawal from Syria would encourage greater Iranian involvement. It depends on what the rate is and what the future of that presence would be.
Were you surprised by the president's announcement at a press briefing yesterday that the U.S. effort is about to wrap up?
I wasn't surprised because I know he has concerns about it. I think the problem remains that ISIS is not defeated and won't be. And unfortunately, withdrawing quickly will ensure that it comes back. It could come back under this administration, and that would be a major problem.
ISIS is not really the problem, though, is it, in Syria?
ISIS is certainly part of the problem, but it's been the main U.S. mission there. The larger issue, of course, is the way the civil war is shaking out.
The Associated Press is reporting that U.S. forces are setting up new frontline positions around Manbij, even as Turkey promises to move its forces east toward Iraq. What kind of a problem is that?
It's a big problem because a showdown between Turkey and the United States will be a big problem for both countries and a big problem for NATO.
How likely is that in your view?
I think it's likely that there will be a lot of tension, but I think clashes hopefully will be handled more carefully. And we've seen some efforts to do that by HR McMaster and Rex Tillerson, the former Secretary of State, but they're no longer in the cabinet or will not be very much longer.
Andrew, we have the last vestiges of rebel presence pulling out of eastern Ghouta. What is the status of this conflict now?
I think it's gone from the Syrian civil war into the Syria war and gone sideways, so to speak.
What do you mean?
The civil war is shaking out with Assad, the Iranians, and the Russians shooting the opposition into submission. But the problem is that the outcome of that war is unacceptable to two neighboring countries. One is Israel and the other is Turkey. So as long as that happens, the war won't end. It'll just be parked, and it could set off some kind of larger conflict in the not-so-foreseeable future.
That's Mideast analyst Andrew Tabler with Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
This week on VOA's Encounter, Carol Castillo and her guests examine U.S.-China relations in the wake of tit-for-tat tariffs, as well as China's theft of intellectual property, President Xi Jinping's increasing authoritarian rule, and Beijing's role in curbing North Korea's nuclear ambition. That's Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues as we turn now to what's happening on social media. We are joined by VOA's Doug Bernard. What's happening, Doug?
VOA has been covering the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a very somber day, and lots of people talking about it using various hashtags, either hashtag MLK or hashtag Martin Luther King Jr. The interesting thing about this is people are expressing not only views of what this person meant in their lives, but, sort of thoughts about where the United States and where other countries are, 50 years after his assassination. It's kind of heartening to see a kind of a robust civic discussion, and that's really occupying a lot of space out there on the social media. Every now and then I like to ask you a question. You probably hate this, but do you know what today is, other than the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination?
Actually, I think I do know. I think I do know.
Tell me.
I think it is National Hug a News Person Day.
You win the big prize today. This somehow escaped me. It has not escaped you because you are clearly a news person. a lot of people are talking about this. And so, for example, I'm just going to take a look at a few tweets here. Here's Dan Rather. I hear today is National Hug a News Day Person. While I appreciate a good hug as much as the next person, may I suggest buy a subscription day and support your favorite hardworking journalist for the year. That's a thought that's been coming up a lot in this day. Palomine Danzak, who's a journalist at the Washington Post and is famously a crank, just tweets out, "Don't touch me." That's kind of Dan Zak's sort of sense of humor. Now, what a lot of people are doing on this day also are sending out virtual hugs to journalists they admire. Here's a young woman who's sending out special hugs to, and then she lists a number of people, Nicole Wallace, April Ryan, Joanne Reed, Chris Hayes. Journalists here in the United States. Chris Zullo tweets this out. "News isn't fake just because it's critical of you. Alternative facts are not real unless supported by evidence. Fox News is the fake news you seek. Ask public businesses to switch the channel. We must fight this machine of fear." And then I just have to, if I may, just end with this. This is from Ethan, who sends out hashtag National Hug a News Person Day. And here come the sexual harassment lawsuits. So I'm not so sure about that, but it's a rare lighthearted moment on social media. But I think people also, taking a moment to sort of say, look, if you appreciate the journalism that you're getting, maybe take a moment to think about how you can support those journalists doing that work.
All right, Doug, we appreciate it. Thank you. Follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a singer born on the Massachusetts island of Nantucket has a new single and a wedding on the horizon. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
Today, we're taking you back to that 50s and 60s retro sound that has been made very popular by the style of Meghan Trainor. Meghan Trainor's back. It's been a few years. She's gone through some different challenges in her career. She had throat surgery. She had to cancel her tour for the second time and rest her vocal cords. So that's been an issue that's bothered her. But she's back now, and she's looking great. She's been working out and exercising, trimmed down, looking fantastic, getting ready for her upcoming wedding to actor Daryl Sabara. He was in Spy Kids, and he's had some other film roles. And the two of them got engaged on her birthday, her 24th birthday in December. So the wedding is coming up sometime this year. She's all excited about that. She's got new music out, which we're going to check out right now. And I'll tell you more about Meghan Trainor after we listen to the new song, No Excuses. What you sipping?
Think the retro music of the 50s and 60s is so popular?
Well, I think it's not necessarily that it's the retro sound. It's all in how it's presented and packaged. And it just so happens that Meghan Trainor, who came out in 2016 with All About the Bass and won the Breakthrough Artist of the Year Grammy Award that year for All About the Bass. And she's had These Lips Are Movin' and quite a few other songs that are all in that sound. It's just that she's kind of captured the sound better than a lot of other people who have tried as well. So I'm not really sure why, but she seems to have the chemistry, the ingredients to be successful. She started off way back when she was about 15 or 16 as a songwriter. She never saw herself as a singer or a pop idol. She always liked writing music, and one day L.A. Reid said to her, "I want to make you a singing star. Why aren't you singing your songs?" And she said, "Well, look at me. I'm not a pop material person." He said, "Yes, you are." And so she recorded her debut album called Tidal in 2015, and as I mentioned, All About That Bass soared up to the top of the charts, and she got all kinds of awards, a couple of Billboard awards. She was, you know, the hottest thing in music for a couple of years, 2015, 2016. She dropped out of sight for the last year or two, as I mentioned earlier. Now she's back, and we're looking forward to what will be her ultimately third album when it comes out, hopefully sometime this year. But she's got a lot on her plate, planning a wedding and doing the other things she's been doing. She's been endorsing products on TV. Very talented young lady from Massachusetts, and I'm very happy to see all the success that she's been getting. She's a great songwriter. She's written for many acts in country music and in pop music, and it's about time she's been noted for what she does best, and that is write and sing her own songs.
All right, thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The UN Security Council's 1718 North Korea Sanctions Committee unanimously approved 49 new UN designations, 21 shipping companies, one individual, and 27 ships, all aimed at countering North Korea's illegal maritime smuggling activities to obtain oil and sell coal and preventing certain entities and ships from aiding them in these efforts. These new designations were proposed in February by the U.S. mission to coincide with the announcement of the U.S. Treasury Department's largest ever North Korea sanctions package and are part of a coordinated effort to continue the maximum pressure campaign on the North Korean regime and systematically shut down its maritime smuggling activities. The U.S. Department of Treasury is aggressively targeting all illicit avenues used by North Korea to evade sanctions, including taking decisive action to block the vessels, shipping companies, and entities across the globe that work on North Korea's behalf, said Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. These sanctions, he said, will significantly hinder the Kim regime's capacity to conduct evasive maritime activities that facilitate illicit coal and fuel transports and erode its abilities to ship goods through international waters. President Donald Trump has made it clear to companies worldwide that if they choose to help fund North Korea's nuclear ambitions, they will not do business with the United States. The U.S. thanks its partners and allies for lending their support to these sanctions. It is a clear sign that the international community is united in its efforts to keep up maximum pressure on the North Korean regime, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley. We want to thank the members of the Security Council, as well as Japan and South Korea, for working with us to keep up the pressure and for their commitment to implementing UN Security Council resolutions and holding violators accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.